Welcome to Legal Trailblazers, where we talk about black lawyers and their role in the ushering in of the constitutional democracy that South Africa enjoys today. I am Thuto Radebe. I am interviewing today Mr. Bernard Makgabo Ngwepe, who is the former judge president of the Gauteng Division of the High Court of South Africa. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you very much.
Your name is Bernard Makgabo Ngwepe.
Yes.
I like finding out about people's names, the motivation or the context between which they were given those names. Makgabo, what does that mean? Why were you given this name Makgabo by your parents?
Well, it's a name I was given. I was named after my grandmother, who had that name.
So
it was. You see, I say in my book that we follow a system of naming after in my culture. We don't just grab a name in the air and give it to a child. There's a particular pattern according to which we name after. And that I was named after my grandmother, my maternal grandmother. We have a system of naming alternative children for both families, paternal and maternal sides. So I was named after my maternal grandmother, and that name comes Makgabo comes from her. That other one, Bernard, didn't come from her. That name, I was told, after I was born, the family wrestled with that first name, so-called Christian name.
In your book, The Rich Pickings Out of the Past, you refer to yourself as a village boy. Why is that?
Well, firstly, is to contextualize myself. And secondly, I think it's important that we should always remind ourselves of where we come from. And there is also a further consideration that sometimes people think that you only make some positive impacts, however humble they might be, only when you come from rich families or rich backgrounds or sophisticated backgrounds or of certain areas and not others. The point, therefore, to drive home is that it doesn't matter where you come from. You can always make some humble contributions to society.
You also refer to the influence that you got from your grandparents.
Yes, and even broader than that. But yes, as you say, I refer to that. But the idea is to tell you that as you are born and as you grow up in a society, you are part of that society. And you get groomed by members of society, by your parents, your grandparents, who, and this is the point, who don't have to be educated or learned, but who are well-versed with the values and lessons of life as far as that community is concerned. So we learn a lot from that kind of ancestry. And let's not disrespect it. Let us always respect it by word of mouth and by deed of action.
Which values did you get from your parents and the bigger family, your ancestry that you have just referred to, that later on stood you well in your career as a lawyer and later on as a judge?
Yes, and even not just from family, but from society at large, the society in which I lived. You see, that was a tribal society, and it had its own values. And these values were taught to us as young people. For example, respect for everybody. Even if you did not know any person, but if that person was in your father's age group, you would accord them exactly the same respect you'd accord your father or your mother, and so on and so forth. And those are the teachings and the values that we were taught in that particular society. And yes, you're right. As I say in my book, later in life, they stand you in good stead. Those are the things that you absorb when you're young. Those are the points of reference as you grow up to steer you from doing bad, to say to you, this is the right thing to do. That's why I say they stand us in good stead.
When then did you qualify as an attorney?
Well, first, let's go back to my date of admission, because it's, in some sense, it's quite historic. I was admitted as an attorney on the 16th of June, 1976. I don't know if it does ring a bell to you.
Indeed it does. I'm old enough to know about it.
Yes. And that was when the Soweto riots erupted. I had just been admitted at 10 o'clock in the morning or quarter past 10 in the morning. And when I got out of court, the country was on fire, Ireland.
Which court was it? In Pretoria?
It was in Pretoria.
Yes.
And things were on fire there. And I was the first ever African or black person to serve articles in exclusively white Africana femme in Johannesburg at the time. Because most of the article clerks were taken by white femmes, but mostly English, almost exclusively English-speaking femmes. So that femme had never had a black person as an article clerk, but I qualified there, and which is why friends of mine used to made a joke out of my admission, and they said, "Well, your admission sparked riots on the 16th of June, 1976.
Yes,
the first African to be admitted as a as an attorney who had served articles in a white African affair. That's why you sparked the riots." But that was the day, ironically, on which I attained one of my most valued and cherished milestone in my life.
Yes. Or was it the hand of God?
Or the evil, I don't know. But certainly, I'm sure, of our ancestor, a combination. But at the end of the day, it was a memorable day, an unforgettable day. That's why I would never forget as to when I was admitted as an attorney.
We have previously interviewed Mr. Mojabilo and Mr. Museneke for this series, both of whom have told us about the hardships or the challenges that black lawyers had to contend with around the time, late 70s, early 80s, in fact, which is one of the main reasons that the Black Lawyers Association was formed, where you were involved in the formation of the Black Lawyers Association, where you were a member.
I was one of the founding members. And perhaps for posterity's sake and information, let's step back a little bit. Let's start from the point of not just problems relating to or problems experienced by black attorneys. Let's take a step back to say challenges experienced by black lawyers even looking for articles.
Yes.
Because that's where the problem started. Once you completed your law degree, you had, as you know, you would have to go and look for a firm of attorneys to take you as their clerk to train you. It was difficult to get that kind of a vacancy at white firms. And we struggled, and some of us had to walk the streets to go in every building where you think there were attorneys to go and look for that vacancy. And I remember at one time, as I say in my book, I remember at one time not getting into a firm of lawyers, obviously white, and I told them I was looking for articles. And the young receptionist looked at me and said to me in Afrikaans, "Ons neem nie aan mense soos jy nie." And that said it all. I understood him. I didn't ask what she meant, because I would have got more than what I had bargained for.
What did that mean, by the way?
I think, to be polite, what she meant was that we don't take black people like you here. But I don't know. I didn't want to ask. She could have used a K word.
Yes.
So I had to leave things there. But I was not deterred, and I would urge all other young black people experience difficulties in getting articles not to give up. I didn't despair. I went on, and eventually, because of interventions by some other people, I got placed with the firm that I'm talking about. So that challenge of finding articles is still there. Now let's go then. Let's fast forward then to after you are admitted, what challenges as a black person you had to meet.
Yes.
Well, there are many, but for one thing, you needed capital to start your practice, which was difficult to get because we didn't own any property. Our parents didn't own any property to use as a collateral to raise finance. And I tried to leverage one particular bank, which had said, once you're admitted as a lawyer, we could give you an overdraft. Little did I know that, in fact, what they were referring to white people. So I was turned down. Eventually, one of the banks was brave enough to give me a facility, and I started my practice. But yet other challenges. I was told, as I was about to start my practice, by one of the partners in that white African-speaking firm, and he said to me, one of the things you are going to find is that black people are not going to come to you. They're going to white people. And my late sister also warned me that black people are not going to come to you. What are you going to do? Your practice won't work.
What was the thinking behind it?
My sister was concerned that it was uncommon for a black person to open office as an attorney. And she was concerned that the same concern that the white partner had, that they are not going to come to me, they will go to white people, and as opposed to a black person. And this is not an unknown phenomenon, by the way, in our societies, but let's leave it there for some other day. For now, I'm just saying to you that there was that concern. That partner said to me, but don't worry if they don't come back to you. If they don't come, black people don't come to you. We as Afrikaners, at the beginning, African-speaking people did not want to come to us as the lawyers. They went to Jewish lawyers. They thought the Jewish lawyers were better than Afrikaner lawyers. But you know what we did? We worked hard to prove them wrong. So don't worry if they don't come to you. You left that challenge. Just work hard to prove them wrong. Obviously, it did happen. Leonard, clever blacks didn't come to me. Yeah. It was ordinary black people who came to me, and we worked well. It was good that I interacted very early in my career with black people, because they quickly reminded of who I was, of where I came from, and where I belonged. And I was therefore able to find my own footing, thanks to the support I had for those black people, ordinary people that we sometimes look down upon. There were one of the biggest problems for black attorneys was that the government didn't want us to open offices in town. They want us to practice in townships where there was no economy at all, and where it still isn't there. So that's why we formed the Black Lawyers Association, to fight that cause, for us to be allowed to practice in the cities and so on, where the economy was, where people were working anyway.
After how many years of having practice as an attorney, did you then decide to practice as an advocate?
I think it was after 8 or 9 years.
What prompted the decision to be an advocate?
Well,
changing from being an attorney?
Mainly two reasons that I felt at some point I had reached the ceiling as an attorney. I felt I had achieved all that I wanted to achieve as an attorney. And secondly, there was a dire shortage of, maybe not even a shortage, virtually an absence of black advocates.
Yes.
So that's why I decided to go and become an advocate. And that was a decision that was taken more or less the same time between myself and Justice Moseneke.
Yes.
The two of us, more or less the same time, branched off to go and practice as advocates.
We'll come to that later on. In your book, you refer to a case that you handled whilst you were still practicing as an attorney. And that case demonstrates the absurdity of apartheid laws and how it had to, those laws, how they had to be implemented by authorities. That case of the Afrikaner man who fell in love with the Mubedi woman. And as a result of that relationship, they fell foul of the Immorality Act. Can you tell us about that case?
Oh, yes. I mentioned that case as one of the very few cases in which I had a white client. But it was a white gentleman who had inherited, I was told, some wealth from his family or a farm sold to go, and he fell in love with an African woman in Sikukuni area, and then he built a house there. They lived together, and they were obviously later charged under the Immorality Act, let's put it that way. And they were charged and arraigned before the regional court in Groblersdal. So they came to me to defend them. I did my best under the circumstances, but they were bound to be found guilty because they were not prepared to deny that they had a relationship. It was difficult in any event for them to do that because they had been living together for some time. But that was one of the cases that really broke my heart because I knew that man had invested all his money into building that house there. And I knew that they loved each other. And the magistrate imposed a suspended sentence to say, you stop, or else if you are found guilty of this again, you'll be sentenced to imprisonment. He suspended part of the imprisonment sentence. Well, all of it, actually. The sentence of imprisonment was suspended in its entirety on condition they did not continue to indulge in that relationship. Now, as I say in the book, with the stroke of a pen, the magistrate destroyed the lives of those two people. And as we left out of court, the woman was dazed and confused. And I had to explain to her what the implications were. And the man also was confused. Their lives were destroyed. The man had lost everything simply because they loved each other. And I went in the book to tell you how they used to investigate those cases, the police. But yes, it was a terrible system.
After your decision to become an advocate, that was in Pretoria. The Pretoria Society of Advocates. You had to become a member of the Pretoria Society of Advocates.
Yes.
In order to be able to work there as an advocate.
Yes.
But I understand there was an issue of their constitution. They had to amend it to accommodate yourself and Mr. Moseneke. How did that pan out?
Well, as you say, their constitution, as it was initially drafted, barred black people from taking membership with them. So before we came in, that issue arose, and some members of the society proposed an amendment to the constitution to remove that bar. And other members opposed it because they didn't want black people to become, to take membership with the society. And there was therefore a huge contest within the society itself. And it was only later when some people demanded that the names of those who opposed the amendment should be made public so that people should know.
Wow.
It was only thereafter we were told that the amendment succeeded because people didn't want to be identified as openly, publicly, as being racist. That was for the benefit of black people. And the first person to come in was Justice Musineke. And shortly thereafter, I joined him as the second black person to join the Society of Advocates in Pretoria.
How many years did you practice as an advocate?
It could be about 10 years or 11 years.
And then you became a judge in which year?
1995.
As a judge, when you are presiding over a case, how important is it to be sensitive to other people's cultural or religious beliefs? When you listen to the case, when you have to draft this judgment, how relevant is it? And is it practical, for that matter?
To
be attuned to the party's cultural or religious beliefs?
Well, that's a very important point, bearing in mind that we are a multicultural society. And when you are a judge, you are a judge to everybody. And people from various cultural backgrounds appear before you. So you need to be alive to that. And in fact, during my term as the judge president, courses were organized for judges to try and build that kind of capacity and sensitization amongst judges to be able to adjudicate in a multicultural society such as ours. So it's very important that you do that. Why is it important? It is because we wanted to move from a situation in the past under apartheid when people of color, that is black people, never felt that the judiciary at the time was theirs or was part of them. Indeed, in so many instances, in many cases which I defended back then as an advocate, many of the political trialists that I defended openly argued that they did not recognize the judiciary. In other words, the judiciary did not have credibility to people, and it was a foreign creature to the peoples. Now, come 1994, we needed to have a judiciary which people will say, this is our judiciary. You needed a judiciary which people will find credible. You can't achieve that if you do not, as a judge, when judging in a multicultural society, you, as you put it, you attune yourself to that phenomenon. Otherwise, you'll be a stranger to your own society. So it's very important.
So it's a huge responsibility on a judge, especially in the new constitutional dispensation, as it was introduced then.
Yes, it's a huge responsibility on everyone who is a judge to do that. And perhaps it goes beyond judges. It's about teachers, it's about ministers of religion, it's about everybody who is involved in any activity in the country. You need to be alive to that.
There's this case that you presided over. It was a murder charge, and there was a possibility of a death sentence being imposed.
Yes.
As you were hearing the case, presiding over the proceedings, at the back of your mind, was there always this thinking that I may have to impose the death penalty, and that I don't like the death penalty? That tension in your head, what happens to a judge in those circumstances? I'm presiding over this murder case. If I convict the accused, I may well have to impose death sentence on them. And I've got a problem with that. What happens there in the judge's mind?
Well, as you say, there may be that kind of tension. But remember, basically, a judge must apply the law as he or she finds it. And mercifully, there are instances where some measure of discretion is allowed. There are very few instances where some measure of discretion is not allowed, particularly when it comes to the issue of sentence. The issue of sentence is eminently a matter of discretion for the judge. So you must apply the law. If people are guilty. You can't say because there's a possibility of sentencing people to death, I must acquit them. No, you must find them guilty as charged. There's no problem about that. You'll find them guilty as charged. And some people have said, judges have said this time and again, that the most difficult aspect in a criminal case, sometimes, very often, is what sentence to impose, because that's where you've got to exercise your discretion. So there was always room for that. And I guess if my hands had been absolutely tied to impose the death sentence, I guess I would have, because I wouldn't have undermined the law. I'd taken an oath to apply the law. But there was a measure of, there was a room for discretion. And I found that room. And I did not impose the death sentence. Not because partly because I didn't like it, but very importantly, I was allowed some room by the law to exercise my discretion to impose an alternative sentence, which was the life sentence.
People refer to the tension that eminently exists between the executive branch of government and the judiciary, which you were part of for a long time. Is this tension inevitable? I'll make an example of cases where the courts find in a particular way, and then mostly we're talking about politicians. They will say, because that judgment that had been imposed by the court is not acceptable to them, that means that the judiciary is interfering or is encroaching in the terrain of the executive. Can you unpack this tension for us?
Well, there's always a potential for that kind of conflict in the manner that you have explained it, in that the executive might very well in some instances say, well, the judiciary is encroaching. It may be the impression that they get. I don't know. Maybe they might be right. In other instances, I don't know, I haven't come across. But maybe in future they may be right, I don't know. But the truth of the matter is that there's always the potential for that kind of tension. And the judges would therefore, I imagine, always be alive to that danger that let's keep within our terrain. It's bound to happen because The executive has to do certain things, and the judiciary sometimes is invited by other people to review, to look at the actions of the executive or their decisions, and then to decide whether or not their actions or decisions are consistent with the law. In other words, to overrule them. When there are cases in which the judiciary would have to overrule the executive, but there's always the potential for that kind of tension.
And the Constitution does allow that, doesn't it?
Yes.
It gives space for that tension to exist.
Well, yes, in the sense, in the way that is structured, it's inevitable that occasionally there'll have to be that kind of tension, because the Constitution, on the one hand, as I've said, allows the executive, gives the executive certain powers to do certain things or take certain decisions on the one hand, and on the other hand, it gives the judiciary the authority to review the actions or decisions of the executive. Once you do that, there's a potential for that tension.
Indeed. Once you were judge, and later on as a judge president, was there ever discussion about the use of indigenous languages in our courts? And where did the discussion go to?
Well, there was such a discussion, and maybe there still is, but there are immense practical problems around that particular issue. For example, if you were to conduct a case, a criminal case, in Spady, in Atteridgeville, and then the person is found guilty, and the person has got to appeal to the High Court in Pretoria, the record is in Spady. Are you going to, when you take that case to the High Court in Pretoria, are you going to look for only Spady-speaking judges to hear that appeal, who can read and follow Spady?
Yeah.
Are you going to therefore, in a sense, marginalize non-Spady-speaking judges? It could lead to some absurdities. Well, some people say you can translate into English so that when the higher you go, that sort of thing. But yes, we all know.
It's not pragmatic.
Yeah, it's very could be expensive. And in any event, to translate a record which already exists, you get people to translate it, you need experts. And people who are linguistic in their inclination and who are eloquent in both languages. And I can assure you, I've been a judge in an international court outside this country for some years, where we used English, French as the main languages, but also Arabic and other languages on the continent.
Which court
and
was
we
that?
Had, we had big problems in writing judgments, because we're 11 judges in that court, so half of them French-speaking, sometimes a 5 be English-speaking and that sort of thing. When you draft a judgment to circulate it amongst yourselves, the draft would come out in French. And I can't read French.
Yeah.
You draft a judgment in French, you give it to people to translate that draft judgment of 40 pages into English in order to send it to me in South Africa to read it and edit it. That translation may not be accurate. There may be some errors. So there's a danger in relying on the mechanism of in translating records in one language and then into another language in order to progress further. For example, to the appeal court, Supreme Court of Appeal, at the Constitutional Court, and a record which had started in Sepedi Natrageville, all the way must go up to the highest court, where people don't even understand Sepedi. Now, yes, the court that I've mentioned as an example is the African Union's African Court on Human and People's Rights. You know, it's a continental court. Yes. So my observations are based on this practical experiences where we met challenges.
Once we're talking about
but
challenges.
Before we go further, it's not for me, though, to prescribe to people what they should do. I'm just sharing my experience. Because at the end of the day, it's a political decision. Some people may want to do so in order to get some political points out of it. I don't know if they're entitled to do that or not to get political points. I'm not there to judge. But I'm just saying they're practical problems.
These inherent
yes,
practical problems that they must be aware of.
Yes, and yeah. There's a real example that existed, which I could give it to you, with a case I think started in Archerville.
Please do.
I can't remember whether it was, the case was in Tsonga or Tswana, but as an example, let us say the case was in Tswana, in Archerville. It was to be reviewed by two judges. The conviction and the sentence of that person had to be reviewed by two judges. Now, the record had to be submitted to the High Court in Pretoria, which was in Setswana. It came to the attention of a white judge. And that white judge did not know Tswana or even Venda, for that matter. That judge thought, oh, this is a record in Venda. I don't understand Venda. Mind you, I said it was in Setswana. Because he doesn't know Venda, Tswana and Venda, the difference. The judge then takes that record, says, I can't read Venda. The judge sends it to a Venda-speaking judge. And the Venda-speaking judge says, no, this is not even Venda. This is something else.
Yeah.
You know, it's a circus.
It is.
It's a circus in the sense that in the meantime, the poor person is sitting in jail. And if there wasn't that kind of roundabout, the record, the case could have been quickly reviewed within 7 days. That is the norm. And if the person is, if the judges were to find that he is wrongly convicted or sentenced, the person would quickly have to be released. But he's sitting there in jail when the record is circulating around.
Yeah.
So we need to be very careful when we come up with such things. We have got to be pragmatic. In my book, there's a chapter devoted to pragmatism, how we should be pragmatic in life.
Yes. During your tenure as a judge president of the Gauteng division, which division is the busiest, they say, in the whole of South Africa, when you started at that position, there definitely were challenges, administrative and otherwise. And as the head of that division, you had to face them full on and, of course, come with a solution. So much was resting on your shoulders. What challenges did you, main ones, if you can just isolate a few, did you have to contend with? And what did you achieve when you left the position? What were your achievements?
One of the main challenges was, as I said earlier, to try and make the post-1994 judiciary credible, for people to have confidence in it, and for people to feel that that judiciary was theirs. It belonged to them. They were part of that judiciary. Now, when I took over as the judge president, there were two situations. One, I was the only black judge in Pretoria. Maybe there was one black in Joburg, I'm not so sure. Secondly, there was not a single female judge in Pretoria. So that is the situation that I was confronted with. That was not ideal. Now, my main objective in getting there was to work towards making sure that as many women and black people as possible were appointed to the court, so that the face of the judiciary should change and reflect the demographics of the country. That was my main challenge, my main objective. And just to deal with it a little bit further before I go to anything else, please, let's chase it to its logical conclusion, because you asked me what did I feel I achieved when I left. Now, having started being the only black judge there, and there being no single female judge, after some years of some hard work and support by a number of people, and after I had run a number of training courses to train black people and women to be appointed judges, a number of them were appointed. There came a point where, in fact, from zero up to after a certain 12 years or so, more than 50% of the judges were black. And there were a number of female judges. Once more than 50% of judges, both in Pretoria and Joburg, were black, I felt that I had achieved my objective. And that's when I decided to leave.
Judge, I'm going to read a few sentences, in fact, which form an epilogue of your book, The Rich Pickings Out of the Past. And please comment about it. I'm reading them because they are relevant to the series.
Yes.
Because this series talks about the past with reference to black lawyers. You say, I hope that, amongst others, we learn lessons from past experiences, including from the experiences of others, get inspiration from them. And then, as you conclude, you say, the present and the future would be better if we were to take lessons out of the past.
Yes. Well, that of course speaks to the title of the book, Rich Pickings Out of the Past, because let me explain the word the rich pickings out of the past.
Please.
I use that preposition there, out of the past, advisedly. I didn't say rich pickings from the past. I said rich pickings out of the past. That conveys the conception that you have to dig deep, like you extract gold or diamonds out of the bowels of Mother Earth. You've got to dig deep, and you will find, if you go into the past and you dig into it, you will be rewarded. You will find certain lessons that we tended to forget. And I use the past because I use the past as a point of reference, because you can't change the past. You can't change history. There are people who try to change history. If rich history is recorded in a way that is not how it was. It's not because history lies. It's because people distort history. History never lies. History doesn't change. And I wanted to use history as a point of reference because history doesn't change. Nobody can change history. For example, you'll find in my book that I talk about people that I defended as political trialists who never lost hope. They were sentenced, some of them sentenced to death, but they never lost hope. If you look in the past, you'll find people who succeeded despite apartheid. Despite apartheid in a broader sense, but in particular, who succeeded academically despite Bantu education. They attained very high levels of life, despite apartheid. It didn't stop them. Yes, it stopped other people, but the people who went through it. There are many people who struggled and invested so much, both black and white, who sacrificed for this country. If we could only learn from them, the sacrifices they made would be better people. And I'm saying that I hope that if we were to do that and realize that people were maimed, crippled, and killed in order to achieve a better South Africa for everybody, maybe we'll be able to learn something so that we don't steal from our people, from our poor people, so that we don't commit corruption, so that we don't take money out of this country stealthily and by theft and impoverish our people, so that we are able to give our people the dream which they had in 1994, which was a better South Africa, which is not there. We have failed to do that because we failed to learn from the past as to how much people have sacrificed for this post-1994 South Africa. But the epilogue you read is a hope. You may want to ask me a political question now, which I won't mind, and ask me, do you think that that hope is attainable? I will say to you, I used to be very hopeful every second, every day of my life that we'll be a better country. But I'm not so sure now. I'm beginning to wonder because we have huge unemployment. We are ruled by criminals. There's crime with impunity in this country. Nobody knows whether we'll ever be able to contain crime in this country. And that's my problem. My fear is that we have removed ourselves so far away from the post-1994 South Africa, which we had envisioned. We are so far away from it that I am not so sure whether now I'm beginning to doubt whether I will be able to go back there. And I look around and I see crime everywhere. I see people putting themselves everywhere. And I see people vandalizing buildings. I see people occupying buildings, hijacking buildings, and all that sort of thing. I can tell you that it may not be a wrong argument to say South Africa is probably one of the most lawless countries in the world.
In his last State of the Nation address, the incumbent president, Matamela Ramaphosa, said we can withstand these challenges because we are a people of hope and resilience. Was he selling us a dummy?
It may not be a dummy, and as the president, as the leader of the country, he had to say that because it is his responsibility to lead this country to a better situation, not to a worse situation. So you cannot be heard to be saying the opposite if you are the leader of a country. What we will be praying for, those of us who are less important, will be to say, let it be so. But the point is that at the moment, the situation is far less than ideal. I hope, a little bit of hope, on one condition, that we sit down, reflect on our past, and learn some lessons, and then correct our ways.
That's the only way.
Yes.
Thank you, Judge.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.